Before we begin, let me apologize for the fact that we're starting 15 minutes late. I want you to absolve my colleagues of any responsibility for that. It's entirely my fault. So my apologies personally to you. Also, before we begin, it's my understanding from the record that at some point, Justice Jacobs, then sitting as a vice chancellor, passed on a TRO in this case. I express that to you. We're aware of it. It's my understanding he has no genuine interest in the outcome or recollection of the circumstances of the TRO and has been focused on the merits of this appeal. But should either side have a problem with the fact that he was picked at random, as you know, that's how we select the panels, totally at random, if that's a problem for either party, now's the time to let us know.
No objection.
All right, then, if you're ready to proceed, we're ready to hear from you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Eric Howard here on behalf of appellants Tim Doyle and Dealer Rewards, Inc. As the justices are aware, this is an appeal from a decision by Vice Chancellor Parsons, tried below in the Court of Chancery. We filed the appeal on a number of bases. I'm going to try to avoid repeating what was already stated in the briefs. I do want to give some general initial background. Mr. Doyle was employed by Newcar to sell what's known as a customer loyalty program. They work in a variety of ways, but it's where you get a swipe tag, and it's sold to businesses to reward customer loyalty, as the name implies. He was employed to do that for approximately 6 years, and on September 18, 2001, Newcar fired Mr. Doyle. There is no suggestion, and there was no evidence whatsoever in the record, that at any time until that unilateral action happened, that Mr. Doyle was doing anything that was in any way at all inconsistent with acting in the best interest of Newcar. This isn't a situation where he was laying the groundwork for going to work for someone else or going to business for himself. That at that point, again, his loyalty was directed unconditionally toward Newcar. There's also no evidence whatsoever that Mr. Doyle signed any kind of non-compete agreement. There was no agreement signed during the course of his employment requiring that he not compete generally or that he not compete by either soliciting current or prospective clients of Newcar.
There was the equivalent of that in the severance agreement, though, was there not?
At the time he was being fired, he was tendered a severance agreement that said, sign this if you want your severance package. And that document purported to say you won't contact in any way any clients or prospective clients of Newcar.
Well, it didn't just purport. It did say that.
It did say, Aaron, but it had no limitation whatsoever as to time. And we believe that agreement to be non-enforceable because of that, and we argue that at trial. And prior to trial, Newcar, in fact, dropped any claims on the basis of breach of the termination agreement. So while the termination agreement did purport to say that,
there's no relief being sought as a consequence of that, correct?
Excuse me, Your Honor.
No relief is being sought.
No relief was sought, and they did not pursue that claim. But we believe that the agreement was not enforceable because of its breadth, not containing any limitations whatsoever, particularly as to time.
Mr. Howard, it would help me if you would tell me what you believe the holding was below and why that holding was erroneous as a matter of law.
Your Honor, we believe Vice Chancellor Parsons made a finding that there was a document entitled a call sheet, but it got called various things throughout the course of the litigation, throughout the course of the trial, but it was a prospect list. In this list that Mr. Doyle it concededly had in his possession, and he did not return to Newcar at the time of the termination of his employment. Now, there was unrefuted testimony that list was never, Mr. Doyle testified, I never used that list. I never even realized I had it. And in the course of responding to discovery, we discovered it and returned it to them. So Vice Chancellor Parsons found that this list and the information on this list qualified as a protectable trade secret under Delaware law. And then he also made the finding that because Mr. Doyle had done business with two out of the 154 businesses on that list, that he therefore had he misappropriated a trade secret and used the trade secret. And, Your Honor, we believe that...
Are you suggesting it's an impermissible factual inference when someone is contractually obligated to return a prospect list, that the prospect list is later in their possession and clients who are contacted are on that list? Is it an impermissible inference that that list was used improperly to do all that?
I believe that is incorrect, Your Honor.
Why is that impermissible? Is that illogical?
Your Honor, there's no question you can prove your case through circumstantial evidence and make inferences through circumstantial evidence. Yes, Your Honor, in this case where there was a list of 154 prospective people, and out of that 154, and one of them I want to deal with differently, McCafferty, because that was Mr. Doyle's client, there's no question that he knew about them because he just called them a week before he was fired. But in this case where you end up doing business with one customer out of 154 on a list, yes, Your Honor, I believe that is not a logical inference to make and shift the burden to the ex-employee to say that you did not use that list to solicit that customer to do business with that customer.
Well, again, it would be helpful to know how the vice chancellor erred. Are you saying that it was an incorrect ruling as a matter of law to conclude that a list of this kind under these circumstances was in fact a trade secret under Delaware law? Or are you saying that he abused his discretion when he found as a matter of fact that contacting two of the people on this list that your client had in his possession violated his contractual agreement with the employer? What did he do that was wrong that you believe we should correct by reversing it?
Your Honor, what we believe was wrong was finding that, one, that it was a trade secret. And that's, I believe, arguably a factual issue. That is a difficult task for us to ask this court to reverse on the finding that prospect list was a trade secret.
You think that's a conclusion of fact and not a conclusion of law?
I do, Your Honor. I would suggest that in an employer situation where you have an ex-employee going out and competing and trying to earn a living, with the court has to be particularly sensitive to is it really enough information here to make this a trade secret? But that is a factual issue. Your Honor, and we just believe there was not sufficient evidence on the record to support that. The larger issue in what we believe...
Well, under what circumstances would the development of a client contact list that is important given the nature of sales in the particular community, under what circumstances would it not be a trade secret?
Would it be?
Well, you take it either way you want.
Well, Your Honor, in this case, I think it was clearly not a trade secret. Because if you look... And Chandler Green, one of the witnesses for Newcar, testified that to the extent it was kind of brainstorming, is more like if you actually look at the list, the type of people that are on the list and the type of information that are on that list, the majority of the people on the list don't even have a particular contact person. They don't have any idiosyncrasies concerning the client.
Well, what did the facts show about how the list was developed?
Your Honor, it shows that the list was developed not through any kind of give and take with the prospective customer of knowing what their wishes or their needs might be or when they might have those needs or who the right person to talk with that customer is, when the best time to contact that person is, any kind of things that would be particularly helpful if you wanted to go out and say, well, the person to talk with is John Smith, and I know that that this is the number where I reach him, and I know that they have.
Mr. Howard, let me just follow up on the Chief Justice's question, because I think it's necessary to refine what issue exactly is important to this case. As I see it, there are three separate issues. One is the client list or prospect list a trade secret?
Yes, Your Honor.
Secondly, if it was it misappropriated? And thirdly, was there loss from the misappropriation, or translated, was it used? As I understand it, the Vice Chancellor found each of those, answered each of those questions in the affirmative, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
The trade secret issue, is that critical to your appeal? That is, does it really matter if it was or wasn't?
If the court finds in our favor on the other two issues, it does not matter.
Okay. And, in fact, the trade secret argument was made for the first time in your reply brief, wasn't it? That is in your opening brief, I don't see any frontal attack on the finding that the client list was a trade secret. What I see is an attack on the finding of misappropriation and perhaps use.
I thought we had attacked that, Your Honor. Perhaps it was peripherally in just describing what the list really was, more of a...
Well, there wasn't... I didn't see it raised in your opening brief. But putting that to one side, there's no real argument here about a misappropriation, is there? I mean, the list was supposed to have been surrendered when Mr. Doyle signed the severance agreement, and it wasn't. So there was a misappropriation in that sense, correct?
Well, Your Honor, I think Vice Chancellor Parsons did find that he didn't obtain it improperly.
I know, but he kept it improperly
once he promised to give it. I don't believe that is a misappropriation. If you've kept it just improperly, stuck in a box somewhere until you actually pull it out and use it,
let's separate out misappropriation from use. He misappropriated it because he kept it when he shouldn't have. Whether he used it or not is another issue. Would you agree?
To the extent, I would not necessarily agree with that, Your Honor, because you're only misappropriating it. It doesn't become enough when you
promised to give
properly.
He promised to give it back, and he didn't do it.
There's no question about that, Your Honor.
Right. Yeah. Isn't that a misappropriation? Now, there may or may not be loss flowing from that, but it's a misappropriation, isn't it?
He did not give it back when he was supposed to. I would not...
I mean, isn't the only issue, the real issue, whether it was used, that is, the misappropriated client list?
I would agree with that, Your Honor.
Okay. And that's a factual issue.
It's a factual issue, Your Honor, but it's a factual issue, but because of the inferences, going back to the question that Justice Ridgely raised about was it a permissible inference to say because he did business with one customer on that list. And I'm saying one because the other customer I wanted, McCaffrey, I believe, is different.
That goes to use, correct?
It does, Your Honor.
Okay, we're getting now into the merits of whether this was or was not a correctual fact finding.
Yes, Your Honor, but it's a factual issue basing your whole determination on circumstantial evidence and making an inference from that circumstantial evidence when it's contrary
right.
to
you're
the
saying,
evidence.
You're saying the court's finding was based on an inference that the court could not make?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Based on the contrary evidence that was of record and taking into account, you have to take into account the type of list this was, too. This was a very broad-based general list. And to have done business with one of the customers on that list, it's improper to say, well, you had, it's not like someone left employment and with Coke and 6 weeks later he's discovered the Coke formula and says, well, I just got lucky, I guess.
Didn't the Vice Chancellor at least implicitly find your client not to be credible?
I wouldn't agree with
that. On the point I just found this list, I never used it.
He makes reference in his opinion a couple of times to that appears to be believable. He says without resolving whether or not Mr. Doyle retained the list innocently, he appears to accept that finding that it was retained innocently, that he didn't intentionally misappropriate it and not return it. And he seems to suggest that... Well, he doesn't suggest that he did not use it. He suggests that there was no evidence other than the inference that he must have used it. So to the extent he's saying I'm resolving a credibility issue, I guess you could say that, but again, that resolution of a credibility issue is contrary to the evidence that it was up record.
Well, he showed there was proof of actual use as far as the first customer, that is, the customer other than Harley Davidson.
McCafferty.
McCafferty, yes. Because the day before Mr. Doyle was laid off, was terminated, there was a notation September 17th about McCafferty, and then not long after that, Mr. Doyle negotiates an arrangement with McCafferty. So that's fairly direct evidence, is it not?
Your Honor, Mr. McCafferty was Mr. Doyle's client, contact person. He was their responsible person. And he's the one that made that entry. He's the one that had called on them. He didn't need that list. He didn't need to know information was on that list to call on McCafferty. He was the one doing it.
How do we know that?
There was evidence on the record to that effect.
But the court rejected that evidence, correct?
I don't believe it rejected the argument that Mr. Doyle, or the position that Mr. Doyle was a responsible person for McCafferty, and he was the one that called on them the week before he got fired.
So the court, as a matter of law, was supposed to conclude that even though Mr. McCafferty read the list, made a notation on the list the day before he was laid off, that he didn't use the list.
But with respect to McCafferty, Your Honor, he would need that list to know that McCafferty was a dealer and that Mr. Book was a contact at McCafferty, because he was the one that was information that was embedded in his memory. He didn't need the list to do that.
Did you want to save the balance of your time?
I did, Your Honor. Thank you.
May it please the Court, Chief Justice Steele, Justice Jacobs, and Justice Ridgely, I'm Robert Penza. I represent the appellee, Newcark Consulting, Inc., the former employer of Mr. Doyle. This case is not about what Mr. Doyle did or didn't do while he was employed at Newcark to what he did after he was terminated. And this case is not about whether Newcark had a covenant not to compete, written obligation between the company and Mr. Doyle. It's about Mr. Doyle acquiring trade secret information while he was employed with Newcar and then misappropriating some of that trade secret information when he started his own competing company, which resulted in a loss to Newcar, his former employer. Chief Justice Steele's question, wanting to know what was the holding below. The holding below was very limited to a finding by Vice Chancellor Parsons that the plaintiff's claim for a trade secret violation, misappropriation, occurred in two places. One, with regard to a customer contract that Newcar had prepared by its attorneys, that within 2 months of being terminated, Mr. Doyle used that contract from his employer with McCafferty and just changed the names, changed the amounts. That's the first thing he did. There's really no dispute, no even discussion here that what he did was wrong. And Mr. Doyle was permanently enjoined from further using that private contract that was developed by Newcar. The second thing that Vice Chancellor Parsons did is with regard to two prospective customers of Newcar, which it was clear that Mr. Doyle had contracts with, the court assessed damages in the amount of unjust enrichment, basically stripped him of some of his profits from those contracts. Not, when I say some, not all. These contracts, with regard to McCaffrey, the first one, it was a contract that was for a term of 3 years that Mr. Doyle was going to gain profits from, but Vice Chancellor Parsons, and Vice Chancellor Parsons had evidence of what the amount of Mr. Doyle's profits were on that contract, but he limited the damages to 2 years.
Help me with the what I perceive at least as a causation issue. The other side seems to argue that it's the list was found later. It's just a coincidence, and the fact that these two prospects happen to be on that list, that's pure coincidence, and that it's clearly a wrong factual finding for the Vice Chancellor to conclude that there was a misappropriation.
Or to put it differently, it was all in Mr. Doyle's mind.
Well, I agree. It was in Mr. Doyle's mind that Todd Buck of McCafferty was interested in a customer loyal program for his auto dealership. And that information was in Mr. Doyle's mind because he acquired it, not as generally known information that's available to the public. He acquired that information during his employment at Newcar. And how did Newcar acquire that information? At considerable expense. They attend a NADA, National Auto Dealers Association convention, once a year, where there are thousands or maybe tens of thousands of auto dealerships show up at that convention. And Newcar sets up a trade booth to market their product and find out who may be of these thousands of dealerships across the country. Newcar is based in Delaware, but they do business nationwide and even in parts of Canada. Who in the country is interested in what they do?
Where were these two contacts located? Were they in Delaware?
McCafferty is in Pennsylvania. And Brian's Harley-Davidson, I believe, is in Delaware. I'm not sure of that. But
in relation to appellant's place of business, were they down the street, drive to work, and
no.
Would drive by these prospects?
No. The appellant's place of business is in Sussex County, Delaware. The first one's easy. McCafferty, Newcar had determined that Todd Buck of McCaffrey was the contact person at McCaffrey that wanted this, and handed to their commercial sales rep that information. Whether it was on the list or not, that information was conveyed to the employee and said, now close the deal. Let's sign him up. Get a contract with him. And as Justice Jacobs pointed out, literally the day before, on September 17, 2001, Mr. Doyle was terminated, he was speaking with Mr. Buck about closing that deal. And in less than 2 months, he did close the deal, Mr. Doyle, with his new company, with McCafferty.
Do I understand you to be arguing that, at least as far as McCafferty is concerned, it didn't matter whether or not the prospect list was retained? That is, even if the prospect list had been given back when it should have been, there would still be a trade secret violation?
You could still have a misappropriation. To have a misappropriation, you have to first have a trade secret. To first have a trade secret, it has to be information from the employer's perspective is not generally known.
So the trade secret is not necessarily the list, but rather, at least in the case of McCaffrey, the fact that McCaffrey was a known, genuine prospect.
Yeah, it's the information about the customer.
The trade secret is, at least as I think I now understand it, that there are literally thousands of prospective customers. But once the employer narrows, whether it's a written list or in the employer and the employee's minds, when that's narrowed to a list of contacts as opposed to potential interested customers, then the knowledge that they're in that narrow field is a trade secret. Is that your point?
That is my point, that it can be under those circumstances if the employer has gone to considerable expense to find that out, and for his
ex-employee Mr. Doolittle leave and start up a competitive company, if he can take that information that the employer went to considerable expense to acquire and he doesn't go to any expense to acquire, that's an unfair competitive advantage that the ex-employee has.
And right. The process by which the universe of potential customers is narrowed down to the prospect list makes that information, the narrowed down information, trade secret because of the investment and effort that was required to narrow down the list. Is that correct?
That is correct, but there's a second requirement also, and that's just the first requirement.
The second being that the employer intends that be kept confidential.
And that the employer has to take reasonable measures to keep it confidential.
Isn't that something that almost every business does? I mean, why would anybody want to publicize their client list?
Well, they may not want to, but they may not take the steps to do so. And if they fail to take some measures to make it clear that they want to maintain the privacy and the confidentiality of that, it's not a trade secret. That's a statutory requirement. That there's two requirements, and that's the second one. And that the employer take reasonable measures to maintain the confidentiality of what they think is a trade secret.
Mark, let's assume, just for the sake of moving us along, that the information on the prospect list constitutes a trade secret. Is it your position that if Mr. Doyle knew in his own mind that the Harley-Davidson client and McCaffrey were two of those prospects, even if he gave the list back, he would still have been misappropriating a trade secret if he contacted them after the separation?
Yes, because in this case, the identity of those two dealerships that he did business with out of the universe in the country of tens of thousands of dealerships that are out there that don't have a customer loyalty program.
Doesn't that explain why the other side is arguing that chain of reasoning in effect imposes a covenant not to compete when there otherwise is none?
Well, he's been competing, and the vice chancellor didn't do anything about the competition with people that he sought out on his own and had contracts with. Damn it, he was not enjoined. The information about this process that we initially sought a temporary.
He was required to disgorge profits, though.
Yeah, he was required to disgorge part of his profits for what the vice chancellor felt was the fair amount of time that it would take an outside party to develop the same information. For an outside party to find out, is McCafferty, is Brian's Harley-Davidson the type of people that might be interested in doing this product?
Well, he was allowed to compete, if I understand this correctly, outside the context of a covenant not to compete, because he was free to solicit the other 9,998 potential customers that may have been out there that weren't on the specially developed and narrowly tailored list that his employer had developed. So he was out competing with four other potential customers for his employer, but not those on the narrowly tailored list, correct?
That's correct. And he has, and to our knowledge, he still is. He still is doing that, and he's free to do that. The court didn't restrain him in any way. Part of the rationale behind the trade secret statute and the protection you want to give to a company that spends time developing this information and takes reasonable measures to maintain it. Here they made him sign a works-for-hire agreement. They acknowledge that information he acquires is property of the business. And on his way out, they reminded him by having him sign the termination agreement that, look, you have to give us everything back and don't go and don't use that information you acquired against us. So they did take reasonable measures.
Help me understand the scope of the Trade Secrets Act in a broader context. Lawyers seem to move around a lot these days. Does that mean because a client list is confidential at one law firm, in fact, there's a duty to maintain that confidentiality, that when a lawyer leaves, he cannot solicit a former client to come see him?
In the same example, you could talk about doctors. And Chancellor Brown had to wrestle with this concept in the Foote case over 20 years ago, and that was part of the basis that came out in the recently in 2002 in the Total Care Physician versus O'Hara case, and in essential which Judge Slice did in that case, essentially following the concept that Chancellor Brown came up with is, you know, if a lawyer or a doctor leaves the practice, there probably is information about the client that belongs to the employer. However, with regard to these professional sorts of services, you know, if an employer, if the attorney or the doctor leaves, the client or the patient ought to be given some notice, not from the departed, necessarily from the departing attorney or doctor, but from the company, to let the client or the patient know, such and such lawyer has left. We'd be interested in continuing to service your needs. However, you're free to, this is where our departing lawyer or doctor will be located if you want to contact them there, or you can use whoever you want. I mean, that's the balance that was struck by Chancellor Brown in the first case and upheld.
Mr. Pinza, as I understand your position, it really doesn't matter whether or not Mr. Doyle kept the client list or the prospect list. What's critical is that he had in his mind the information about the two critical prospects and then followed up on that after the separation. Is that fair?
It's certainly fair with regard to McCafferty because we know that he was working on getting that deal done with Mr. Buck, and he followed up and finished the deal, but with his own company, with Mr. Buck. So the list wouldn't have helped him do that. But part of Vice Chancellor Parsons getting to, did he also misappropriate trade secret information with regard to Brian's Harley? And on that one, the court did reach an inference. Well, you know, clearly there was a misappropriation of the list, and that name was on the list, and he did a contract with them. And so the court took that as some evidence, some circumstantial evidence, to draw a factual conclusion that list may have helped him.
That was at least a prima facie case. The other side had the burden of rebutting it and didn't meet the burden.
He didn't suggest any way as to how he came up with Brian's Harley Davidson on his own as a part of some independent, generally known process. I don't recall that there was any evidence to suggest a competing way in which he got it. So with regard to Brian's Harley, I think that was a factor.
The retention of the list was an essential step as far as Brian's Harley was concerned.
I don't know that I would call it essential, but it was a factor that
Would there be liability even if the list had been given back at the time of the separation?
There may have been if the Newcar could have proven that Mr. Doyle knew about Brian Tarley as a potential prospect of Newcar, and then he took advantage of that information with his own company.
But that wasn't Newcar's case, correct?
Newcar didn't have to do that because he had the list.
I mean, Newcar didn't. It wasn't Newcar's position that subjectively Mr. Doyle knew about Brian's Harley Davidson being a prospect at the time.
I think it was Newcar's case that everyone on that list that Mr. Doyle had during the time of his employment and that he was supposed to give back.
The reason I'm asking these questions is that, you know, you appear to be arguing that retention of the list is not necessary to prove use or improper use, that is, loss. But I'm not sure the court reasoned it that way, and I'm asking really whether this is a disconnect between what the court reasoned in its opinion and the argument you're making today.
It's my recollection that that the court used the list more so with regard to Bryan's Harley than they did with McCafferty, because it was the information. Was the information a trade secret? And having it on the list made the information more readily available to Mr. Doyle. If the information is just information embedded in his head, he wouldn't be enjoined from using that or assess damages for using that unless the employer can prove that that information embedded in his head should qualify as a trade secret. And the employer wasn't able to prove that the program that he uses, the technical components that he learned and he put together uses for his business.
But the employer did prove that the prospects on the list were trade secrets.
Yes, they spend $25,000 to $50,000 a year to go to this NADA convention. They spend $20,000 to $30,000 a year on mailers to try and find out, to try and get feedback from who responds to those and who might be interested. And then they do some follow up to weed these people down to assign to their commercial sales people 60 to 100 of these narrowed down leads. Follow up, close the deal. And he took that information, and in less than 2 months, he followed up on one of those.
Is the expenditure of money required or essential to that? What if just in house a list is developed?
That's a consideration. I mean, at what expense and what value is it to the employer to do it? And that was a factual determination that Vice Chancellor Parsons listened to. What did it take to come up with these names? And at least with regard to these two, Mr. Doyle had a competitive advantage to pursue them. And that's all that the case was limited to. There was no injunction, no right. Damages assessed for anybody
else. So
Vice
Chancellor Parsons said, yes, you can compete. You're not contractually prohibited from doing it. However, you are prohibited from, in effect, misappropriating the investment that it took to get that list and by imposing an unjust enrichment damage award, we're going to make you pay back some of that investment.
And he found his conduct to be willful and malicious and assessed attorney's fees pursuant to the statute for that conduct.
Would it satisfy a violation of the Trade Secrets Act if, under this scenario, the president of the company comes in, gathers everyone and says, you know, during the night, I spent some time thinking about it, and these were our five prospects. And then someone leaves and contacts one of those prospects. Is that a trade secret?
It probably isn't, because if in the middle of the night the president came up with that, what really did the company expend to do that?
All right. What if it's all day yesterday while at work I came up with this list?
Then it becomes a factual determination as to whether all day yesterday was enough of an expense to qualify that first leg, first element of the trade secret statute.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'd like to respond just very briefly to the question I believe Justice Ridgely was asking about lawyers. The analogy I would make is if you're a lawyer and you work for a large law firm and you know your specialty is employment law, and you know that it's your former law firm is courting someone because they have a racy employment issue about to come up. They fire you, and you're with another firm, and you say, well, I know that employer has a difficult law issue coming up, and that's what I'm good at. That's my specialty. I'm going to go see if I can help them because I was talking to them when I worked for this other firm. To suggest that is a trade secret, and you can't do that because you acquired that knowledge while you were working for the other law firm that employed you is just ignores reality. And that's not what happens. And I suggest that's not what happened here. The information with respect to McCafferty was not is not a trade secret. He knew that information in his head, and Vice Chancellor Parsons
makes two problems with that argument, don't you? One is the court found the other way, And secondly, you never raised it on appeal until your reply brief.
As far as it not being a trade secret?
Correct.
Your Honor, we did argue that the information that is in his head is not a trade secret as it relates to McCafferty.
So if it was a trade secret, the moment it was developed, and then it's told to Mr. Doyle, the mere fact that it's in his head erases the fact that it's a trade secret?
Well, but Mr. Doyle... No, I don't. You can have trade secret because it's in your head. I mean, there's no question. I concede that point that Delaware law does not distinguish between whether it's a written form or something you've memorized. If you have a photographic memory, that doesn't help you. But it's information he created himself through performing his job. He's the one who contacted McCafferty. He's the one who dealt with him. He's the one who knew that they might be
interested. When you say he created it, was he the one that knew to contact McCafferty, or did he do it at random, like my good computer voice Brian does when he calls me every night about DirecTV around supper time? Was it developed that way, or on his own, or did he develop it through the trade conference information that his employer expended money to acquire and then found out during the ordinary course of his employment? In your view, would that make a difference?
I don't believe it does make a difference, Your Honor, because it's what he was doing. I can't say what the record showed. I can't recite here what the record showed, revealed on that. There might be evidence on the record that McCafferty's name was gleaned from the NADA convention. I'm not positive of that. But I don't believe it makes a difference because it was just information he garnered through calling on customers in the context of his employment and what he does for a living, what he was assigned to do.
But he would have called that customer because that customer was developed by his employer's effort to acquire a list of most likely positive, responsive customers, rather than just a random call by looking through the phone book for similar businesses and phone numbers to call and see if they might be interested.
That's possible, Your Honor. I don't believe that makes a difference. Once he's the customer, once he's getting the contact that deals with that person, he therefore establishes the relationship, and he's the one who's doing it. Just like the analogy with the attorney, I don't think that makes a difference how that list was created. Brian's Harley Davidson, there's been a lot of talk about the auto dealers and going to this NADA convention and spending a lot of money, but there's no evidence that Brian's Harley Davidson was created that way at all. They're a motorcycle dealership. And one last comment on the damages issue. As we raised in the brief, we believe the court inappropriately put the burden on us to disprove damages by ignoring that the exclusivity provision that prevented Newcar in any event from contracting with McCafferty. It's our position they couldn't have contracted with them anyway, and how did they suffer any damage? And the court just kind of put the burden on us to prove that they would not have obtained a waiver of that exclusivity clause.
But the award wasn't one of damage. That is, it's not a damage award that presupposes loss to the other side. It was an unjust enrichment award, not a compensatory damage award. So doesn't that sort of eliminate the problem? That is, doesn't it render irrelevant the problem of the waiver?
I don't, Your Honor, because it's still an unjust enrichment. And if Newcar was in any event precluded from contracting with McCafferty by reason of their contract with Team Toyota, there's no unjust enrichment on behalf of unjust to the detriment of Newcar, because it wasn't to the detriment of Newcar. They could not have contracted with him anyway.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
We'll take the case under advisement. Recess.